Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Leitza Horan. I'm a recent graduate of the George Washington University Law School. I also serve as a student liaison to the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers, not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled Emerging Applications of the Congressional Review Act. Our moderator is Laura Stanley, an associate in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. She practices in the firm's litigation department and is a member of the Environmental Litigation and Mass Tort Practice Group. Laura previously served as an economist at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where she developed regulations under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act and the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. Laura graduated with high honors from the George Washington University Law School, and she previously served as a law clerk to the Honorable Ryan D. Nelson of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and the Honorable Stephen S. Schwartz of the United States Court of Federal Claims. One note for our audience before we begin, if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I'll turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Laura, thank you so much for joining us and moderating today's discussion.
Thank you so much, Alicia, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting today, and especially to our three speakers who are joining us today. And I will introduce them in a moment, but first I want to set the table for our conversation. This panel is going to examine a recent development in the Congressional Review Act, not only for environmental law, but also for congressional procedure and administrative law more broadly. The Congressional Review Act, although once obscure, is now relatively well known, and it's a statute that gives Congress a fast-track process to review and, if it chooses, invalidate federal agency rules after they are issued. The recent development arises from California's longstanding authority under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act to seek waivers of federal preemption so that it can adopt and enforce vehicle emission standards that are more stringent than the federal standards. Now, Congress created this special arrangement under the Clean Air Act decades ago in response to California's air pollution problems and because California had its own pre-existing regulatory regime for vehicle emissions. Once California has adopted its standards and EPA has granted a preemption waiver, other states can then choose to adopt California standards under Section 177 of the Clean Air Act. So over time, EPA has granted California well over 100 waivers and authorizations under Section 209. But more recently, California has issued regulations that are novel in stringency and scale that have subsequently received preemption waivers from EPA. For example, in December 2024, EPA granted California a preemption waiver for its Advanced Clean Cars 2 program. This program phased in increasingly stringent electric vehicle requirements for passenger cars, culminating in an effective ban on gasoline-only new passenger cars by 2035. Historically, EPA's waiver grants were viewed as adjudicatory or quasi-adjudicatory determinations that were done at California's request. So in other words, they were not treated as general rules of applicability that EPA has to send to Congress under the Congressional Review Act. The Congressional Review Act requires that before a rule can take effect, the issuing agency has to submit the rule to both houses of Congress and the Comptroller General for review. Members of Congress then have 60 days to introduce a joint resolution of disapproval that can proceed under expedited procedures. Most notably in the Senate, where debate is limited and the measure can pass by a simple majority, effectively bypassing the filibuster. If a joint resolution of disapproval is enacted, the rule cannot take effect, and the agency is barred from issuing a new rule that is, quote, substantially the same. In January 2025, a couple weeks before the start of the second Trump administration, an op-ed ran in the Wall Street Journal with a new idea. Certain key California waivers are actually rules of general applicability, not adjudications, especially where they authorize California to ban the internal combustion engine. As such, the Congressional Review Act calls on EPA to send these waivers to Congress for consideration. And because EPA previously refused to send the waivers to Congress for review, the 60-day time limit to introduce joint resolutions of disapproval had not yet started to run. And we're very lucky to have one of the op-ed's co-authors joining us today, Michael Buschbacher, and I'm sure he can explain the op-ed much better than I can. So we look forward to hearing from him today. So just a few weeks later, in February 2025, incoming EPA leadership took the novel step of transmitting three key California waiver notices to Congress as final rules. And this paved the way for eventual Congressional Review Act resolutions of disapproval. And one of the waivers at issue was for California's Advanced Clean Cars 2 program with the electric vehicle mandate that I mentioned. Congress then used the Congressional Review Act to disapprove EPA's waivers. And one aspect that made this disapproval process particularly notable was that both the Government Accountability Office and the Senate parliamentarian concluded that these EPA waiver decisions were not rules subject to the Congressional Review Act. California and 11 coalition states are actively challenging the use of the Congressional Review Act to revoke the waivers granted by EPA. And that lawsuit is currently pending in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. While these developments raise important questions about California's role in shaping vehicle emission standards for the entire country, it also raises deep institutional questions. For example, what counts as a rule under the Congressional Review Act? How much weight do or should congressional actors give to institutional referees like the GAO or the parliamentarian? And if the Congressional Review Act can reach actions like these waivers, what other agency actions might become subject to it in the future? These questions sit at the intersection of administrative law, congressional procedure, and separation of powers. And our speakers is each going to bring a distinct perspective to these questions. So I'm going to introduce all of them briefly before I turn it over to them. So first, we're going to hear from Michael Buschbacher. Michael is the managing partner of Boyd & Gray PLLC, and it leads the energy and environmental law practice. He was recognized by Politico as the top attorney representing industry opponents of electric vehicle mandates, and he works on regulatory strategy from rulemaking through merits litigation before the Supreme Court. This includes serving as a co-counsel in a recent 7-2 win in Diamond Alternative Energy versus EPA. Michael is a frequent Wall Street Journal contributor and former DOJ environmental lawyer. He's also a graduate, magna cum laude of Notre Dame Law School, and a former clerk to Judge Batchelder of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Then we'll hear from Professor Alan Morrison, who is an adjunct professor at George Washington Law School, where he served as the Associate Dean for Public Interest for more than 16 years until February 2026. He currently teaches constitutional law and civil procedure at GW. He founded the Public Citizen Litigation Group with Ralph Nader, where he served as the director for more than 25 years. He has argued 20 cases in the Supreme Court, where he continues to file amicus briefs on a variety of subjects. He previously served as an assistant U.S. attorney in SDNY and was a commissioned officer in the Navy after he graduated from Yale College and before he attended Harvard Law School. He's also taught at Harvard, NYU, Stanford, Hawaii, and American law schools. Finally, we'll hear from Professor Jonathan Adler. Professor Adler is the Tazewell Taylor Professor of Law and the William H. Bell Research Professor at William & Mary Law. Prior to joining the faculty, he was a professor of law and the founding director of the Coleman P. Burke Center for Environmental Law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Professor Adler is the author of seven books, or editor of seven books, and his articles have appeared in publications ranging from the Harvard Environmental Law Review and the Yale Journal on Regulation to the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Washington Post. He has testified before Congress a dozen times, and his work has been cited in the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Adler is also a contributing editor to Civitas Outlook and a regular contributor to the popular legal blog, The Volokh Conspiracy. He also clerked for the Honorable David Sintel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. So our speakers are each going to bring very interesting perspectives on the Congressional Review Act and the emerging issues. So first, I am going to turn it over to Michael, who's going to do a deeper dive into the California waivers and some of the legal issues surrounding the CRA resolutions of disapproval.
Well, thank you, Laura. And it's a pleasure to be here, especially with such distinguished co-panelists. So our story, as Laura mentioned, starts in the 90s, in 1996, you know, the era of a bipartisan consensus that the era of big government should be over. And interestingly, the Congressional Review Act was the brainchild of none other than Federalist Society co-founder David McIntosh, assisted in that labor by Todd Gazziano, who is a frequent Federalist Society contributor. So the context here, right, the legislative veto is gone after INS Vichada. It's the heyday of Chevron deference. So there's a concern about out of control agency actions and the lack of a good pathway for dealing with those. So the CRA is passed. It's not a controversial piece of legislation at the time, bipartisan support in the House. It's unanimous in the Senate. And as Laura mentioned, the key features are that resolutions of disapproval of an agency rule of general applicability go through expedited procedures. It's much faster than normal legislation and doesn't have to go through the filibuster process, meaning that it's in that sense very powerful. But in other ways, it's pretty circumscribed. As was already mentioned, right? Rules, not every agency action is a rule, and not every rule is a rule of general applicability. These are terms that the CRA borrows from the APA. There's also this time limit that the CRA imposes. So there's a 60-day requirement or 60-day window after which its procedures no longer apply. There's also this idea sometimes called a look-back procedure, which means that the time is, as a practical matter, longer when there's a turnover in administrations and a new Congress. They can look back a little bit further, but even that only goes back a little bit into the last year of the prior presidency. And that last point matters, right? Because no president is going to sign, be pretty unusual for a president to sign legislation repealing one of his own agency's actions. So the list of CRA resolutions over the years, pretty small. Agencies know how to avoid them. The Biden administration was very good about shepherding its marquee regulations through the process well in advance of that 60-day dragnet. The other thing that's sort of, I don't know, odd about the CRA is CRA resolutions are laws. They go through bicameralism and they go through presentment. And it's really a statute codifying Senate and House rules. And actually, if you look at 802G in the CRA, it talks about how both houses of Congress can make any, they have a constitutional right to change the rules at any time, not by going through bicameralism and presentment, but simply by doing so on their own, which is a job that the Constitution gives to each house respectively. The other thing that's a little bit odd about it is that means that follows from this is that it's sort of a, maybe the way Adrian Vermeule would describe it would be a gray hole. There are legal procedures in place. There's legal language, but there's not a restriction in the way that law normally restricts action, because in a CRA resolution is law to the exact same extent that a law changing the CRA or changing the Clean Air Act or anything else would be a law. So that matters, I think, because you do get a lot of commentary on the stuff we're talking about today where people say, well, Congress didn't follow the CRA, didn't comply with it, but one Congress cannot bind another. It doesn't mean that these restrictions don't matter, but they can't bind. I just think it's important to have in the background as you're thinking about how this statute works. And what's also interesting about it is the GAO process that Laura mentioned, where you can go and ask, any lawmaker can go and ask the Government Accountability Office for an opinion about whether something that hasn't been submitted needed to be submitted. And if GAO says, and this always takes a long time, but if GAO writes back and says, this should have been submitted, Congress has treated this as constructive submission, but this is a pure ad hoc thing that Congress does on its own. It's not in the statute. It's just a custom. And conversely, and this is important as well, GAO has said for many years that if an agency action is submitted to Congress, even out of an abundance of caution, and that's the exact quote from the from these opinions, or these letters, it gets treated like a rule. And there's no GAO opinion about it. It just goes through the normal process. So what we argued in the op-ed was that waivers of Clean Air Act preemption contra a 2023 GAO opinion letter are in fact rules of general applicability. And the reason for this is that, you know, it's not like when you think of what is an adjudication, an adjudicatory order is something like a Social Security disability benefits determination or a broadcast license or grazing permits. Those are the kind of specific things that that are orders under the APA. Waivers are different. They have a prospective effect. They empower states to do something in the future. In fact, the Clean Air Act says that states cannot adopt or attempt to enforce regulations related to new motor vehicle emissions without a waiver. So it applies to the future. And it applies to a broad and unspecified class of individuals, not just to California, but to all the other states that under Section 177 can adopt those regulations for their own, and also to the automakers who are then directly authorized to sell California approved vehicles, certified vehicles in those states in the future. And the Clean Air Act actually says that compliance with that, with those provisions that California has, if they have a waiver, counts as compliance with the federal requirements. So, and the last thing I'll say about this is that it's a delegation of rulemaking authority. It's an exclusively federal area with motor vehicle regulation, and the delegation to California and other states is giving away some of that power to those states. And there's a case out of the Ninth Circuit called Yesler Terrace Community Council versus Cisneros, which says that that has, quote, all the hallmarks. Such delegations have all the hallmarks of a rule. It wasn't talking about the waiver program. It was talking about a HUD, Housing and Urban Development regulation that gave states authority to impose their own requirements. But the point is the same, which is delegations of federal authority to states to do regulatory stuff count as rules. So, you know, GAO being in the position that it had already taken, what we suggest in the op-ed was that we should, you know, that lawmakers should take GAO at its word when it said that stuff that's submitted even out of an abundance of caution gets treated as a rule, and that GAO doesn't have any involvement in the process from that point onward. That is not actually what GAO did. GAO reversed its position in record time. They're not very fast normally, but in just a few days after getting a request from Senator Whitehouse, they flipped around a letter saying that EPA's submission of these waivers was not proper, not required by the Congressional Review Act, and that the CRA's expedited provisions did not apply. This went through a complicated and sort of drawn out internal fight, the details of which are still me being just a litigator and not a not a sort of one of these wonderful Hill procedure geniuses. I still don't quite understand all the contours of it, but the bottom line was that the parliamentarian said that she would defer to GAO. Parliamentarian is sort of, there is a repository of procedural experience and knowledge for figuring out what past practice in the Senate has been. And what the Senate ended up deciding was that it was going to determine for itself whether something is subject to the CRA or not, and not run it through GAO or the parliamentarian. And they did this through an interesting procedure about whether points of order are in order. It was very, it's sort of endlessly redundant and sort of hard to follow, but basically there was a test provision that they put in to adjudicate who gets to decide. And they decided that the Senate acting as a body, not GAO and not the parliamentarian, is the one that determines whether a agency action should be treated as a rule or not. And they said that anything submitted gets treated as a rule, and that it's up to the individual decision of each lawmaker about whether to vote for it, where that's where the check and interpretive part of the process takes place. So as Laura mentioned, these resolutions of disapproval were put in place to get rid of three very expansive and costly electric vehicle mandates. All three of them had bipartisan support in the House. And in the Senate, the repeal of ACC1 also had bipartisan support from Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, who crossed over and voted with Republicans to repeal that waiver. So California has sued. Its suit, which I'm happy to get into the details of more later, pushes several novel theories. I'm counsel in that case. I'll just, full disclosure here up front. Though we represent interveners and our intervention motion was denied, that's a whole separate issue. And that's currently on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. But the substantive issue in California's complaint is that Congress violated the separation of powers, and EPA violated the separation of powers by accepting the waivers as rules. This is effectively a kind of Bank Marcosi versus Peterson sort of argument that there's a legislative adjudication and that's not Congress's job. That has a lot of problems in my view, including that Congress can tell agencies what to do. It's not telling a court what to do, which is what Bank Marcosi is about. It's not making a adjudication about applying pre-existing law, but making a new determination about whether these waivers should continue or not. In other words, it doesn't get into whether the waiver should have been issued under the Clean Air Act, but just makes a determination as a matter of policy that Congress didn't want it. They also make it sort of 10th Amendment, structural principles of federalism argument, channeling South Carolina versus Baker, arguing that the sort of cumulative defects in the national political process deprived California of its constitutional rights. Those defects are in my view, pretty weak sauce for them to be arguing. They say that there wasn't enough debate. They didn't let state officials testify and they didn't have the filibuster. Of course, no one's entitled to testify in Congress and certainly no one is entitled to the filibuster. So I don't see how that has much merit to it. I think the key point is CRA resolutions cannot violate the law. They could violate the Constitution, I suppose, but they can't violate the law. They are the law. And the other very interesting aspect of the case is that there's a provision stripping courts of jurisdiction to review determinations under the CRA. It's a pretty broad jurisdiction stripping provision. Nevertheless, courts have said in the past that it doesn't apply to constitutional arguments. Whether it does or not, however, seems like mostly beside the point in that litigation. Because again, I just don't see any right to a filibuster or a right to testify or the idea that Congress can't make these sort of determinations about whether California should be able to ban the internal combustion engine. So I think that's a good little intro summary on this and looking forward to this discussion.
Thank you so much, Michael. I should have said at the beginning, but if you have questions, please go ahead and drop them into the chat as they come to your mind, and we'll come to them at the end. So next, Professor Morrison is going to talk a little bit about the broader implications for Senate procedure and the filibuster. I think might also respond to some of the things that Michael just mentioned. So I'll turn it over to you, Professor Morrison.
Thank you, Laura. I normally don't have to do disclaimers, but I want to be clear that I do not represent the views of the state of California or any other plaintiffs in this matter. The views of this matter are entirely my own. Oh, the first question is the waiver a rule? It is surely a matter of broad application. It applies not only to California, but to a whole bunch of other states. It affects obviously the auto industry and many others as well. The effect of it is to amend an existing rule. The existing rule says what the standard shall be, and California gets to amend it by having a broader standard. The California argues that this is not an amendment to a federal rule. This is a matter of state law. Well, no, it is a state law that California is trying to implement, but it's the federal law that says whether it can or cannot be implemented. And that's the subject of preemption, which is quintessentially a federal law. Further support for the fact that this is a rule is that the judicial review goes to the Court of Appeals, where rules go. But on the other hand, this procedure has been in effect since 1996, and it's never before been applied to waivers of this law or any other law. Everybody has proceeded on the assumption when waivers go forward that they don't have to worry about the major rule requirements for $100 million. As Michael pointed out, that if Congress doesn't like what an agency has done, it can ask the GAO for an opinion that the agency has not been following the law by sending it to Congress. Never done that before. There's also an exclusion for rules of specific applicability. I don't quite know what that means, but it's obviously intended to mean something. But to me, the single most important reason to think that these waivers are not subject to the CRA is that the GAO and the parliamentarians for years have taken the position that they don't apply. It's not just that they don't think so, but who they are the defenders of congressional prerogatives. And if the GAO doesn't defend congressional prerogative and the parliamentarian doesn't defend congressional prerogative, seems to be pretty strong indication that responsible people do not think that this is an applicable law. Finally, I would say this is an exception to the APA, an exception to the usual congressional rules. If Congress doesn't like what the CRA says and does, it can change it at any time, but it's never done so until Michael got clever enough to figure out a way to get around all of this. So if I were deciding the question, I would say that these waivers do not have to be sent to Congress under the CRA. But none of that seems to me to matter, or almost none of it seems to me to matter. As Michael pointed out, these resolutions are laws. They were passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the president. And it is irrelevant, in my judgment, that they violated the CRA, at least with respect to the disapproval that they have given here. And that is because the court has been clear in many cases, Field and Clark is one of them, that even if you can show that Congress didn't follow its own procedures, didn't have a quorum, none of that matters. It's a law. And the notion that we can go behind what is a law and have trials about what Congress did or didn't do seems to me to be wrong. And therefore, it seems to me that these disapprovals are valid laws. But that doesn't quite end the question, because the CRA also has this very nasty provision that says that agencies whose regulations are disapproved, may not issue substantially similar regulations going forward without express congressional authority to do so. And therefore, I think that if the court agrees with me that the waivers are not subject to the CRA, the court could and should make it clear that these laws that pass, which specifically apply only to disapproval of these, that the CRA's provision does not apply, then therefore that the EPA, obviously not under the Trump administration, but under future administrations, could issue waivers consistent with the CRA without having to go back to the Congress to get specific authorization. I think that's a very important limitation, but it obviously doesn't do anything for the current situation. Now, let me say the last thing, and this is why I agreed to be on this panel. I care deeply about the impact of the lack of waivers, but that's not my biggest concern. My biggest concern is here that Congress has, the Senate in particular, has rejected the views of the Senate parliamentarian. I looked at these points of order, and they seem to me to be a flim-flam, an excuse, a way of getting around what they're supposed to do. Of course, the Senate can change its rules anytime it wants. It can change, it's specifically authorized in the CRA and in many other provisions to change the rules, but it has to do so directly. And those points of order were anything but direct. Michael said that he didn't understand them, and I don't sure that I understand them, except I understand the final result, which is that we disregard the rules of the parliamentarian. And if we can disregard the rules of the parliamentarian here, we can the Senate can disregard the provisions of the parliamentarian elsewhere. No reason why it can't rule that the filibuster is not lawful without going and doing what it should do if it wants to eliminate the filibuster. It can surely do this in the Reconciliation Act. Around the reconciliation, the parliamentarian made a number of very important rulings this year about what could and could not be in budget reconciliation. If these point of order maneuvers work, then the parliamentarian becomes irrelevant. The parliamentarian is, in my view, one of the last bastions of neutrality, the GAO among them that we have in the Congress today. President Trump has urged the Senate to fire the parliamentarian. Don't have to do that. We just simply can disregard what the parliamentarian says. I would be okay if the Senate wants to pass a resolution amending its rules to eliminate the filibuster and eliminate and change the rules in the CRA. But it cannot and should not do it through the back door, which is what happened here. So those are my views, and I'm glad to discuss anything further. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing, Professor Morrison. In a few minutes, Michael, I'll give you a chance to respond, and particularly interested to see if you think there's any limiting principle on disregarding the parliamentarian's views on this. But first, I'm going to let Professor Adler give us his thoughts, and then I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here. What I want to do is I want to say a little bit about how this dispute about the waiver kind of fits into the broader context of how the Congressional Review Act is being used today, and perhaps say a little bit about what we should expect going forward in terms of how the Congressional Review Act is utilized. So just in terms of thinking about the broader picture, you know, ever since the Supreme Court's decision in INS versus Chadha, which invalidated the unicameral legislative veto, Congress has been looking for ways to discipline agencies in a more formal way than comes through simply the use of the appropriations process or the use of oversight. And the Congressional Review Act was, you know, one idea enacted in 1996 that's short of something like the RAINS Act or something that would formally recreate the dynamic of the unicameral veto. And, you know, the idea here is that Congress, whether we like it or not, likes delegating power to agencies, likes giving agencies the authority to issue broad regulations and make substantial policy decisions. But Congress also wants to have the ability to second guess or to discipline agencies, both to prevent agency shirking, but also agency aggrandizement. And the Congressional Review Act was a limited step in that direction. And we've already heard a little bit about how it operates. It's worth remembering that the Congressional Review Act is enacted in 1996, is only used once in the following 20 years. It was used once in the Bush administration to reject a rule that had been adopted at the end of the Clinton administration. But since 2017, it's been used quite expansively. Part of that, I think, is a function of the fact that the Obama administration in particular was a little bit lax in protecting or insulating rules from CRA exposure. I think also, and the fight over the California waiver is emblematic of this, Congress has become more aggressive. Congress has said, look, we have this tool, we created this tool. How can we deploy this tool more often to serve as a way of disciplining agencies, constraining agencies without having to reenact the statutes or amend the underlying substantive statutes and deal with all the procedural headaches that sort of thing can entail? So the CRA was used 16 times in the first Trump administration, only 3 times during the Biden administration, that lower number in part because the first Trump administration was a little more careful in exposing rules to the Congressional Review Act's time-limited window, and because I think congressional Democrats were somewhat ambivalent about using the Congressional Review Act as it's not broadly supported among Democrats. But in the second Trump administration, it's now been used 23 times and in some ways that are more expansive and more aggressive than it had been used historically. So the waiver is certainly one example of that, of Congress substituting its view for what is a rule that should be subject to the CRA's requirements or that of the GAO. And if the parliamentarian ratifies or follows the GAO, the rules of the parliamentarian. I'll just note here, just as a quick side note, hardly the first time the parliamentarian has been overruled. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen. It has happened before. We've certainly seen it happen with regard to judicial nominations, such as when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid overruled the parliamentarian on cloture for judicial nominations. So it has happened, doesn't happen a lot, but certainly has happened, and it's something that the majority has the authority to do. The other kind of more interesting way in which the Congressional Review Act has been getting used more aggressively is with regard to some other actions by agencies, documents like guidance documents, resource management plans, and the like, that we don't always recognize as rules. I say don't always recognize as rules because for the folks that spend their days in administrative law know there's a longstanding game that goes on between agencies and regulated entities about how to characterize the things that agencies do. For a wide range of reasons, agencies often like to put forward policy measures that have the practical effect of being rules without actually having to go through the procedural requirements of being a rule. And so there's often a lot of litigation where the agency might issue something, they might call it an order, they might call it a guidance, they might call it a policy statement, they might call it something else. And when they get sued, they say, oh, no, this isn't a rule. No final agency action. Or we weren't required to comply with Section 553 of the Administrative Procedure Act. In the past, if an agency did that, it would generally be disclaimed, or at least in a post a post-Mead world, they would be disclaiming Chevron deference for that action. That's no longer the case given the overturning of Chevron and Loper Bright, but there is still this trade-off that agencies deal with. Well, the Republican Congress sought to rescind various resource management plans and orders relating to the management of public lands under the view that, well, these things operate a lot like rules. They are broad policy measures that determine how agencies are going to act, that affect lots and lots of people, lots and lots of interest groups, can in effect be cemented in place for an extended period of time, and they therefore bear all the hallmarks of a rule. Interestingly enough, when Congress asked the GAO about this, the GAO actually agreed that resource management plans for federal lands are rules under the Congressional Review Act. And this meant, this accomplished two things. On the one hand, it avoided a fight with the parliamentarian over what's a rule. But the other thing it did is that because the relevant agencies had never submitted these plans to Congress, therefore had never started the clock for use of the Congressional Review Act, it operated as starting the clock later. That it wasn't until the GAO said, hey, wait, this is in fact a rule, that the clock began, which meant that Congress could use the CRA to rescind agency actions, in this case, resource management plans, that had been adopted much earlier, had, say, for example, been adopted in 2022 and therefore would not normally be subject to rescission under the Congressional Review Act. Most recently, in fact, just last month, the president signed into law a Congressional Review Act resolution rescinding Public Land Order 7917, which had, again, never been submitted to Congress as a rule, because the agency hadn't thought it was a rule at the time. The GAO and Congress concluded otherwise. And this was an order that was issued that would have effectively taken over 200,000 acres out of mineral and geothermal leasing for 20 years. And Congress concluded, the GAO concluded, that certainly looks and operates like a rule. The fact that the agency hadn't submitted it means that it can be submitted now and be rescinded. And that is, in fact, what was done. There may be litigation over that. That would not surprise me that there would be litigation over that, much like there is over the California waiver. I think the outcome in both cases is going to be the same. I generally agree with Alan's view on the justiciability point. That is to say, I think under doctrines like relating to the enrolled bill rule and the like, something goes through bicameralism and presentment, a court is not and should not look under the hood to see what sort of process Congress used. Congress ultimately decides whether its own internal rules were followed, and that's not something that courts traditionally have second guess, I don't think should. We were talking before the call briefly. I see California's arguments on that point to be very similar to Texas's arguments, trying to throw out legislation on the grounds that a quorum, that there was no legislative quorum, that generally this is the sort of thing that courts should not be in the business of examining. I'm not so sure that Congress's rejection of the parliamentarian and GAO's view should have an effect on what we might characterize as the anti-circumvention provision of the CRA, basically the provision that prevents agencies from re-promulgating a regulation that has been rescinded. There again, I'm not really sure that's a door that courts should open. But this is an area where we're going to see litigation about the Congressional Review Act, because it's one of the outstanding legal questions. When Congress uses the Congressional Review Act to rescind an agency action, whether a traditional regulation, something like the California waiver, something like a resource management plan, what does it mean that the Congressional Review Act bars the agency from promulgating a new rule that is substantially the same as that which was rescinded? The only court that has addressed this significantly thus far is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in a case called Ohio Telecom versus Federal Communications Commission. There, the panel split over how to read that substantially the same limitation. Basically, what the Sixth Circuit concluded was Congress rescinded this broad rule that the FCC had adopted. The FCC reissued only a portion of that rule that had been rescinded, therefore it wasn't substantially the same. That if Congress rescinded a rule that consisted of A plus B plus C plus D, nothing stops the agency from repromulgating A or repromulgating B because the part is not substantially the same as a whole. My own view is that interpretation of substantially the same basically creates a roadmap for circumvention of the Congressional Review Act's limitation. And I certainly would love to see that decision reviewed. There is a petition for en banc rehearing that is pending, but it appears the court is holding deciding on that petition in abeyance while the FCC reconsiders the underlying rule. In the case of the California waivers, I do think there's actually a slightly different question or about what's substantially the same, because California would certainly argue in future years, and a future EPA might accept, that a waiver for a different California standard applying to different model years and perhaps adopting or imposing different emissions thresholds or creating slightly different incentives for the shift from fossil fuel vehicles to electric vehicles is not substantially the same as the rules at issue here. And I think that would actually be an interesting question about whether or not substantially the same in the Congressional Review Act requires some sort of kind of detailed congruence between the two rules at issue, or whether or not it's kind of the orientation or the general thrust of a rule. That is to say, would any waiver for a greenhouse gas emission standard be substantially the same as any other, or does it have to be more closely aligned in terms of the degree of emission reductions anticipated and the like? That's something that I think courts will have to wrestle with in the future. But I will pause there, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you so much, Professor Adler. And I suspect California is asking itself the same questions right now. I don't know if you know this, but Governor Newsom issued an executive order last summer directing California to start developing Advanced Clean Cars 3, which will be the predecessor to Advanced Clean Cars 2, which was disapproved under the Congressional Review Act. So I'm sure they're asking themselves the same questions. So I'm going to turn it back over to Michael to respond.
Yeah, well, I find myself very much in agreement with a lot of what Professor Morrison says. A few responses on the areas where I disagree. But first, just you asked about what rules of specific applicability are. I think those are things like rate makings, where it's done through a rulemaking process, by, for instance, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission or something like that, but it applies to a specific entity. I'm sure you can come up with others. I can't remember the name of the case, but there's a case that says that agencies get to decide whether they want to do something through adjudication or through rulemaking. Though that Yesler case I mentioned does say sort of the effect is what matters, not the form. And I think that's got to be right. And there are some cases saying that basically everything an agency says is a rule. There was a case we had in the Fifth Circuit. You may remember the FDA, you're not a horse, you're not a cow, seriously, all stop it with about ivermectin. We challenged that. That was a legacy Boyden project back when he was still around. He really cared about that. And we got the Fifth Circuit to say that that was indeed a rule. So I think it gives you an idea of how broad that is. Statement of general applicability and future effect. So on the point, I do think I disagree about if I think you can there are good faith positions on the argument about whether waivers are rules or adjudicatory orders. I think reasonable minds can definitely disagree about that. I think in our op-ed, we actually said that waivers are kind of the duck-billed platypus of administrative law, because they do have different bits of different things sort of tacked all together in a unique way. I don't think that that opens the door for judicial review in the future, though, because the jurisdiction stripping provision says that any determination, finding, action, or omission under the CRA is not subject to judicial review. And Congress did make a determination here. And if you look at the resolutions, they are, you know, they say that they're being done under the CRA. Again, it's a new law. It's kind of a funny situation where you're saying you're doing something under a law to pass a law. But bracket that for a second. I do think the key point there is that there's a determination that Congress made that this was subject to the CRA. And I think it would be, I agree with Professor Adler, it would be a mistake for courts to open that up in the future. The other thing I think where I disagree most strongly is about the role of the parliamentarian. So first, a couple of factual points. The parliamentarian said, didn't make any sort of independent rule order analysis here. Her view was that she would defer to whatever GAO said, which has been a historical practice. And as I mentioned, GAO is the one that changed its position. GAO's historic position was anything that gets submitted as a rule, even if done so, again, out of an abundance of caution, it's going to get treated like a rule. They changed their position in record time. And I think it's GAO's fault for politicizing what should have been a neutral process. I think there's room for criticizing the merits of their earlier letter. But I think the maneuvers they made in the second letter after these waivers were submitted clearly invited a political response. The second point is that the parliamentarian was not overruled. She did not make a recommendation to the, you know, president of the Senate or the president pro tem saying, here's my recommendation about this. You know, because the way it would work is someone introduces the resolution, someone else says, I object, a point of order. That point of order is that this is not allowed because it's not a rule of general applicability. And then the parliamentarian would advise based on her view of what GAO had said. That was sort of the prior, that's sort of the background there. And what the Senate did is the Senate did simply followed a different procedure. They had a point of order on, like I said, it's confusing, but this point of order about whether points of order are in order when you're talking about CRA resolutions. And that was determined directly, as they have done on many prior occasions, that was determined directly on the floor of the Senate by a vote and not by consulting with the parliamentarian. So there was no consultation, there was no overruling on this. And, you know, to the extent that those details matter, I think it shows that there was, you know, all the sort of jots and tittles of internal procedure were followed here. And there are just people who are unhappy with the result. Final point on this is that the parliamentarian's role is important, but it is ultimately the institutional prerogative, the one that I'm most concerned about, even if you disagree with everything else I said, is that Congress, as Professor Adler loves to delegate, delegate stuff away from itself. And a big part of the reason that it does that is because if you make a decision, you're going to be held accountable for it. And here you have a reassertion of Congress's power in a lawmaking way on a very important matter. This was an area where I think the polling was like 80-20 opposed to electric vehicle mandates. And they followed the will of the American people to make a change that was in their interests. And like I said, it was bipartisan. I think that is something really to celebrate. I think it is a misallocation of power historically to agencies, something that the Federalist Society has been debating and discussing for years, for decades. And I think it's pretty cool that there was an instance where Congress asserted its own prerogative and changed things in a way that reflected, you know, the will of the American people and that made sense as a matter of policy.
Thanks, Michael. Professor Morrison, would you like to add anything?
Sure. Setting aside land looks kind of like I want to go back to the first point about rate setting. Rate setting kind of looks like more like a waiver. To me, it's individualized treatment. Waivers, individualized treatment. As far as judicial review is concerned, this would not be review of what happened under the CRA. The judicial review would be the effect of compliance or noncompliance with the CRA, and so it would. I don't think it would come under the prohibition on judicial review because the question would arise: the agency wants to issue a new waiver, and the question is that waiver valid? The question is it valid or not valid? And it's only invalid if the CRA has been complied with. That's how the case would come up. In any event, I agree that it's not obvious as an obvious point either way on that. As far as the parliamentarian is concerned, I don't think I know enough to go into the details about all these points of order and what they did and whether they did it. I think it seems to be pretty clear that there was no debate on the question of should we follow what the GAO says and what the parliamentarian has said in the past, and whether we should do it directly, change the rules, decide what we want to do. If that's okay, I'm all right with that. But this doesn't look like that. And I see the opportunity for sleights of hand and concerns. If Congress is asserting its authority, that's fine. But it didn't do that in my judgment. And as far as bipartisanship is concerned, a rule against the auto industry with one Democrat from the state of Michigan doesn't strike me as being bipartisan. As far as everything else is concerned, you know, I think there's actually a fair amount of agreement on this panel that the state of California and the others have a very uphill road to go as far as the current end of the waiver is concerned. What the impact it will be later on is a different matter. I do want to express a concern, however, about the notion that the GAO said that anytime a rule is submitted out of abundance of caution, they will treat it as a rule subject to the rule. That's fine if it's done by the agency which issued the rule, that is the old agency. And the presumption is that the agency is being cautious. Here, we know that the agency was being cautious. It was trying to undermine the rule by taking it forward and bringing it into a posture that wouldn't have been possible without the agency submitting it because the 60 days had run. But beyond this particular situation here, I'm concerned that the notion that any agency can resubmit a rule without time limits whatsoever, 5 years down the road, I suppose that if the Democrats get back in office, they can send up a whole bunch of things that agencies did way back in the beginning of the Trump administration that were never sent forward. And that will then trigger the Congressional Review Act. I find that very troubling. There needs to be some kinds of statutes of limitation. It seems to me that the ability of Congress to ask the GAO, is it a rule, and treat it as a rule if the GAO says it, is enough of a protection for Congress without them being able to get a new administration to submit a very old rule that doesn't may or may not be a major rule or may not be anything else subject. And it then becomes subject to the Review Act. And maybe this is a flaw in the statute, but I would find ways, if I were a judge, to try to find a way to prevent that kind of thing from happening. Not we're worried about 2 weeks, 2 months before the end of a president's term, but going back to the beginning of the president's term, or for that matter, the president's term 5 years ago. Could do it as well, just because you could submit the resolution. So those are very troubling things to me. And I would try to find a way not to allow the law to be interpreted in that manner.
Thank you. We only have a few minutes left. I don't know if Michael...
Can I in 30 seconds respond to that very quickly? Sure. So one, there was debate. They had a very late night Votorama thing about this where, you know, you can, I listened to all of it. It took forever. It was not short. It was shorter than it might have been, I suppose. But there was a real debate, a robust debate. And it wasn't like this happened overnight. This went through extensive internal discussions within the Senate. To the bipartisan support in the Senate was there was only one person who crossed the aisle, but in the House, I believe there were over a dozen members of the House, including, I think, three California Democrat Congress men and women who voted for the CRA repeal. So I do think it is meaningfully bipartisan. It's not just, you know, one vote that switched. I'm not so troubled about the timing thing. It's very easy to immunize stuff from a long look back. You know, you just send it. If you are worried about something getting undone as an administration, something you did earlier in your tenure, you should just send that letter to Congress. It takes, you know, it's not a lot of work to send that over, and then the 60-day clock will have run. Of course, Congress can still repeal things if it wants to, but the idea that, you know, that was operative here in this instance with about stuff being sent over that was never sent before would not obtain.
I just had real quick, at least with regard to the RMPs, I mean, the GAO concluded that on the merits, they satisfied the definition of rule under the APA. And so, in effect, it was an error by the agency not to have submitted them. It meant there are a lot of them that had never been submitted, but it was not merely the fact that a later administration, you know, wanted to go after them.
Awesome. Thank you. So I'm going to jump over to an audience question first and try and get at least one or two in. So someone from the audience asks, in a post-major question doctrines world, should Congress pass a new review act to review and potentially stop agency actions that it believes has major economic or policy significance? So do you all see any appetite for a congressional review act type piece of legislation going forward? I assume nothing at this point could get past the filibuster, ironically. But anyone want to speak to that?
Well, the CRA kind of already does that in some respects, and said this procedure is available for any such action. I mean, the real question is whether or not there's ever any appetite to do something that would prevent such actions from taking effect unless and until Congress has approved them. That's more or less the Reins Act model. That's the model that then Judge Breyer suggested was a way around CHOTA if Congress wanted to do it. It gets talked about a lot. I've written extensively in support of it, but it doesn't appear to me that there's political appetite to take that step, let alone to get past a filibuster.
I'll just make one observation, which is that people still do CRAs when they don't have the presidency for their party. And I think actually the major questions doctrine is implicated by this, because if you have something that generates, you know, that much attention in Congress and passes both houses of Congress, even if it's not signed by the president, that is a strong indication that the question is of political significance.
And really quick on that, I mean, another way that I think the CRA is beginning to be used in a way that maybe had not been anticipated is that the opposition party, because CRA resolutions are privileged, can use the CRA to force members of the majority, members of the president's party, to go on record about controversial things that the president is doing. And for those of us that would like to see Congress become Congress again, that's actually a positive step, right? Because it is forcing members of Congress to actually take votes on contested questions. And, you know, that's something that in general Congress should do more often.
I would agree with Jonathan's last remarks. That would certainly be a good thing. I don't know that it's being used that way, but maybe it will be sometime.
Thanks. I was going to ask one more quick question. I think we're almost out of time, but just something I'm curious about. A lot of folks and commentators, as you all have discussed, have argued that this episode has weakened the filibuster norm. But is it possible that a more expansive use of the Congressional Review Act could actually protect the filibuster norm, at least in regard to having the filibuster around to protect from new sweeping pieces of legislation, while giving Congress, you know, an outlet for the bare majority to disapprove actions that it's, you know, displeased with? So could this actually fundamentally protect the filibuster norm?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the intent of the way it was passed, was to create something that was sort of a pressure valve so that Congress would, on major pieces of legislation, be going through the deliberative process and deal making that the filibuster requires. But that for, checking administrative overreach, you would have a faster route. I think that's a healthy thing. I think it pushes things in the right direction. The thing I like about the filibuster is that it prevents major changes in a new direction. And by definition, the CRA is about checking the same kind of thing. Like if you have overreach, it's about slowing that down, making sure that it's not going forward without public support, which I think is great.
Thanks, Michael. Does anyone else have anything final before we wrap up? All right, well, thank you all so much. Thanks to our speakers and to the Federal Society for hosting. Good afternoon.
Thank you to our panelists for sharing your expertise and opinions on this important issue. And thank you, Laura, for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about the Federalist Society's program, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.